This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. In today's program, we consider whether or not politicians are adequately contemplating the rights of women to choose. We'll be looking at the Aiken controversy and the status of women's reproductive health and rights in America today. We'll be speaking live with Jody Jacobson, the president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. Also today, we'll speak with investigative journalist Gareth Porter, who has done a remarkable new study on the actual extent of civilian deaths by United States operation of drones around the world. All that and more. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The nation is ablaze with the controversy of the remarks of Todd Aiken, a Republican contender for the Senate, who recently made the famous statement that in his mind there is such a thing as a legitimate case of rape. And he has been asked to step down by Republican leadership because of the embarrassment in his Missouri Senate election campaign, but at latest word, he is saying that he has no intentions of quitting at this time. We begin today's analysis with the actual first statement that he made when he was being interviewed by Charles Jaco on the Fox News program, The Jaco Report.
So if an abortion could be considered in a case of, say, a tubal pregnancy or something like that, what about in the case of rape? Should it be legal or not?
It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something. You know, I think there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be in the rapist and not attacking the child.
That was Todd Aiken speaking on the Fox News Network about his conception, pardon the expression, of what he considers to be a legitimate case of rape. That stuns the consciousness to try and figure out what such a thing might be. And in order to try to clean up the damage, he subsequently released this campaign ad called Forgiveness.
I'm Todd Aiken, and I approve this message. Rape is an evil act. I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize. As the father of two daughters, I want tough justice for predators. I have a compassionate heart for the victims of sexual assault, and I pray for them. The fact is, rape can lead to pregnancy. The truth is, rape has many victims. The mistake I made was in the words I said, not in the heart I hold. I ask for your forgiveness.
And that Todd Aiken and the campaign that has very much centered on women's reproductive rights throughout the United States. But the irony is that Mr. Aiken's comments are perhaps not at all unrepresentative of the conservative bent of the Republican Party. And in fact, similarly, anti-choice provisions are being written into the Republican platform even as we speak. We are now joined live by Jody Jacobson, the editor-in-chief and president of RH Reality Check. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Jody.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just begin with how do you possibly understand this debate that's taking place?
Well, for one thing, I think, you know, the focus has been on Congressman Aiken, who, in a sense, misspoke in that he said something that probably the GOP wishes he hadn't said, but in the more true sense, did not misspeak at all because he spoke the words that the GOP believes and is now writing basically into their GOP platform. There are several issues. One is that he used the term legitimate rape, and that actually is a term that they use because what they want to do is change the law, and Congressman Ryan actually had co-sponsored and voted to pass a law that would have changed the definition of rape to be forcible. Only forcible rape would be a legitimate rape, and what that means is that a forcible rape is the kind where the stranger comes and takes you away with a knife or a gun and rapes you, whereas, you know, the greater part of rapes and sexual assaults that happen in this country, and in fact worldwide, are at the hands of an intimate partner, someone you already know, or might happen as a date rape, or might happen in other, you know, marital rape. So the GOP doesn't like those kinds of things because they're too fuzzy for them, and also it upsets Christian fundamentalists who don't think that there's anything wrong with a husband taking, you know, raping his wife if he wants to. So they didn't like the cat being let out of the bag, but the fact is that what Todd Akin said is what the GOP meant. And now Akin is trying to kind of smooth over the words, but he's basically saying the same thing. If you heard what he said, you know, the perpetrator and all of these other things. Basically, they're not really talking about the full spectrum of rape victims.
For the benefit of the discussion here, could we take a moment to speak about what the crime or the violation of rape is? There is, of course, the violent kind, one that involves physical coercion, but it's my understanding that the real dimension of the crime is one in which power or force or undue leverage is used in order to take advantage of another person's body, whether it be male or female, for that
matter.
Absolutely.
Whether it be male or female, you know, transgender, heterosexual, homosexual, anybody, unfortunately, is a potential victim of rape. And, you know, that's just true. And, you know, rape has been used as a weapon of war, as a weapon of intimidation, as a means of keeping women in and others in violent relationships. It obviously also happens in the rape of small children. You know, we unfortunately have seen in the news too often in recent years. So, yes, it is the use of force, intimidation, or emotional abuse to sexually abuse or violate someone else.
We're speaking with Jody Jacobson of the RH Reality Check. And one of the disturbing things about these developments is that it may, as you indicate, turn out to be that Akin was the nice one in so far as the entire Republican Party platform is moving rapidly forward on the suppression of women's right to choice. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Absolutely. What's happening basically is, you know, rape is one of the so-called, or used to be, one of the so-called acceptable conditions or exceptions for when conservatives thought it was okay for a woman to terminate a pregnancy. That's no longer the case. As with everything else, they've kind of steadily shifted, I think purposely steadily shifted the debate further and further to the right, where now they will openly talk about really no exceptions being valid. In fact, Governor Romney said in one of the primary debates that he would easily and gladly sign a law that would include a total ban on abortion. So that would mean that rape victims, life of the mother, anyone would not have access to an abortion for any exception or reason. Now, what's happening with the GOP platform is that they're seeking to enshrine in the platform a promise to pass a so-called Human Life Amendment, which basically is the same in law and policy as a Personhood Amendment, which means that at the moment of fertilization of, you know, the joining of an egg and a sperm, you have declared a legal person to be existing within the body of a woman who now has rights over her body. And rights that also exceed her own rights. So what you have is the effort to pass these personhood laws at the state level, Mississippi, Colorado, et cetera. They've been resoundingly defeated, but nonetheless. And now at the federal level through the GOP platform. And the personhood amendment or the human life amendment would not only ban all kinds of abortion, but would also ban many forms of birth control, in vitro fertilization, would criminalize miscarriage. There are any number of outcomes of such laws that are a major goal of the radical anti-choice movement that is now basically controlling the Republican Party.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. We are speaking with Jody Jacobson of the RH Reality Check. And the platformizing of anti-abortion in the Republican Party is, it seems to be part of an even larger process that has to do with health in addition to one's moral, personal, economic, family choices. How does this impact on the physical health of women generally across the country?
How would this amendment have, what effect would it have on the physical?
Yes, in terms of health care that involves the possibility of abortion procedures.
Well, you know, there are several levels of issues going on. One is that right now, even now, we've got a situation where most counties in the United States, by far the vast majority, 82% of counties, don't have abortion providers available. And so the majority of women in the United States no longer live somewhere where a safe abortion care is available. And you've got a string of states who have which have passed laws that, like Virginia, for example, or Texas, where they are mandating that women undergo, even so far as transvaginal ultrasounds, which are completely medically unnecessary, you know, waiting periods, counseling by doctors of outright medical lies like links between abortion and breast cancer, which have been disproven, all required by law to dissuade women, to make them abortion more inaccessible, to drive up the cost, to close down clinics. So we're already facing that. What we'd see under, I think, a Romney-Ryan presidency would be swift passage if, you know, if they had at least one house of the Congress of laws that are fairly draconian. There's an effort to overturn Roe v. Wade. There's an effort to pass this Human Life Amendment. They absolutely have tried to, and Romney has promised, to defund Planned Parenthood, which then, you know, forget about abortion care. You then have millions of low-income women without access to contraception, breast exams and referrals for mammograms, cervical cancer and pap smears. I mean, you have a whole ripple effect of health care that's removed. And, you know, then the attacks on Title X and Medicaid. So it's not really just about abortion. It's about any and every form of reproductive health care that's under attack and right now are really diminishing in access because at the state level, all of these things, abortion care, contraceptive care, family planning services, are under attack.
Passage of this kind of legislation in localities and states, is this in any way possibly related to the underground operations of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which, as we have seen, has quite a pattern of passing conservative legislation in localities in order to bypass the federal process but achieve the same effect?
Yes. Yes. There's a range of efforts at the state level to pass laws that directly challenge Roe. So you have, for example, 20-week abortion bans, which are based on the medically disproven idea that a fetus can feel pain at 20 weeks gestation. And so those bans basically do pose a real problem for women because many tests that that show fetal anomalies that might exist aren't viable until after 20 weeks. You can't really have those tests effectively, and so you wouldn't know, for example, that the wanted fetus you're carrying has an anomaly incompatible with life and won't survive. And those 20-week abortion bans therefore shut off the possibility of a woman getting abortion care at that time in her pregnancy and forcing her to carry to term or till she miscarries. What that does is it sets up a direct challenge to Roe for several reasons. One is because it puts an abortion ban on before viability. Another is because it's based on misleading medical information. So you've got all of these challenges that are trying to bypass the federal level and at the same time efforts at the federal level to try to sort of pass blanket laws that will then be used at the state level. So there's a two-pronged effort underway, kind of, if you will, squeezing both sides.
What about the duopoly of the Republicans and the Democrats? Are their mobilizations taking place on pro-choice women within the Republican Party, and how do you assess the overall political electoral process in regard to this issue?
That is a really, really important question, and I will say that to date or so far, I have not seen anything that I can tell you is an encouraging sign of Republican pro-choice women at the platform party level organizing. I cannot say that there aren't women at the state level who are not organizing, you know, and complaining to their party officials or what have you. But I don't see that there really is a moderate contingent in the Republican Party anymore, and certainly not one that has any clout. So, you know, you see, for example, Romney and Ryan trying to get Aiken out as quickly as possible because they don't want to be asked questions about these policies because they're in the platform and they see the uproar that's happening over Aiken, and Ryan has voted for these things. So they want to get him away as quickly as possible, even though they're supporting those platforms anyway. And, you know, you've got groups like Susan B. Anthony List and Americans United for Life and supporting Aiken because they say, well, he's just saying what we want to do. So they're really, even there's nobody saying these policies are wrong, we don't like them. They don't have any power left in that party.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. That's Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check. Jody, tell us about what you do at that institution there.
RH Reality Check, it's www.rhrealitycheck.org. We are a daily online publication on reproductive and sexual health and justice issues. So we do news analysis and commentary every day that focuses on these issues, everything from abortion care, contraception, health policy, health reform, Medicaid, poverty issues that relate to poverty, immigration, and, you know, things like voter ID that might affect people's voting rights that then affect their health and health equity. We deal with sort of the whole package of those things.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on this burning issue of reproductive rights.
Thank you so much.
Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check. And in regard to the Todd Aiken Missouri Senate election campaign, there was indeed earlier today an announcement that he, at this point in time, considers his campaign to be viable and that he intends to continue his reelection run. He made that announcement on the Mike Huckabee Show. And he is the former governor of Arkansas. And during the conversations of Mr. Huckabee, he said the following statement, and this is a direct quote. There are good people that come from birth after rape. He said, and we quote, Ethel Waters, for example, was the result of a forcible rape. I used to work for James Robinson back in the 1970s. He leads a large Christian organization. He himself was the result of a forcible rape. And so I know it happens, and yet even from these horrible, horrible tragedies of rape, which are inexcusable and indefensible, life has come, and sometimes, you know, those people are able to do extraordinary things. End quote. Mike Huckabee, here is now Todd Aiken's announcement that he will continue to run on this platform.
Congressman Todd Aiken, the GOP nominee for the United States Senate in the state of Missouri, joins me here on the Mike Huckabee Show. Congressman, thank you for being here. Good to have you.
Mike, thank you so very much for once again allowing me to join you and your wonderful audience. And just right off the bat, to start things out, Mike, I want to make things absolutely clear, and that is we are going to continue with this race for the U.S. Senate. We've given it a lot of thought, and the first thing we felt we had to do was we had offended some people, and we tried to respond to that and let people know that we didn't mean anybody or to take in any way rape anything less than very, very seriously. But following that, I've had a chance now to have run through a primary, and the party people said, when you win the primary, then we'll be with you. Well, they were with us, but then I said one word and one sentence on one day, and everything changed. So now we're kind of back to where we were in the primary. But, you know, I tell you, I've been so encouraged by good friends who are closer than brothers. And I realize now that there are a lot of other brave hearts who don't fit into the political parties exactly. And I believe the defense of the unborn and a deep respect for life, which underlie all of America, those are important parts of who we are. And they're not things to run away from. And, you know, and I agree with the many people in the party. It's absolutely appropriate to speak of the Obama-McCaskill-induced crisis of jobs and the economy, but it's also appropriate to recognize a creator God whose blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is the very source of American freedom. And that part of the message, I feel, is missing. And I think that that's something that we need to encourage people and to let people remember in their hearts what it is that makes America such a great nation. And life is very much part of that whole thing. And that's the reason why we're going to continue, because I believe there is a cause here and that there is a part of the message that's missing. And a lot of people feel left out of the parties.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we are joined now live by investigative journalist Gareth Porter, author of a remarkable new study in regard to the civilian drone deaths in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Welcome to the Shadow, Gareth.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Well, now, how have you taken the reports of the Obama administration and the ongoing killing campaign in Pakistan and Afghanistan, almost indistinguishable, and the administration's persistent announcement that only those who die were terrorists, and the classification of all young and old men as being combatants and such? How did you begin this report and cut through that official rhetoric?
You know, how this story happened is that I was in Pakistan last summer and had an opportunity to meet with the Pakistani lawyer of a number of relatives of drone strike victims. And he had gathered data from the families of these victims over a period of months, late in 2010 and early in 2011, was still gathering material data from them when I spoke with him in Islamabad. And he turned over to me in a briefing that lasted perhaps an hour and a half, the details of 10 cases, 10 specific drone strikes in which the family members had talked with him and given him the details of exactly who had died in each of those strikes, each of those 10 strikes. And so I was able to begin to piece together a picture of, a set of data that contrasted very sharply with what one picks up from looking at the New America Foundation website, which is the sort of standard source of data for journalists trying to follow the progress of the drone war in Pakistan. And so I actually spoke with him about doing a story on this, and he encouraged me to wait until he had gathered gathered data on another roughly 15 strikes from the drone strike victims' families. And so I agreed to do that, and I came back to Washington and kept in touch with him. But as it turned out, he turned the data over to two academic institutions in the United States, at Stanford University and New York University, and I was never able to get the additional data. But now what has happened since then is that the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, which has been doing very good work on the drone war in Pakistan, collected data on 13 strikes in late 2010 and early 2011. I'm sorry, late 2011, early 2012, excuse me. This was a group of strikes specifically targeting either funerals of victims of previous drone strikes or targeting people who were trying to rescue the people who had been wounded or dig out from under the rubble the bodies of those killed in previous drone strikes. So what we have here is a total of 24 cases where we have documentation which was gathered from the local area, from either families or eyewitnesses or people who knew for a fact who had died in those strikes. And that is the data that I present in this article. And I'm able to show on the basis of this new evidence that the accounting that we have been given from the New America Foundation, which is the only sort of systematic accounting available otherwise, is fundamentally wrong in terms of its assessment or its estimate of the percentage of the deaths that are civilians versus the proportion of deaths that are what they call militants. So I can give you very quickly the summation of the change that we now see in the picture. The New America Foundation estimated on the basis of its data of these 24 strikes that about 30% of the victims were civilians and 70% were what they call militants. What I found from the data from these two sources based on original people who were actually on the ground and knew is that the actual percentage of civilian deaths in these same 24 strikes was 68%. So it's a very dramatic change. I'm sorry, not 68, 70% rather than 38%. So it's a dramatic shift in the balance here between civilians and so-called militants.
We're speaking with Gareth Porter, the author of Cover-Up of Civilian Drone Deaths Revealed by New Evidence, and the disparity between family members and those locally on the scene who report what happened versus the, I guess, the administration-friendly informational obedience of some organizations raises what may be a difficult question, but I pose it to you in any case. Is there not possibly an intrinsic weakness in the reporting by certain institutions that characterize themselves as human rights agencies?
Well, I think that's a very fair assessment. I think human rights organizations have really fallen down in not being more attentive to the seriousness of this crisis in terms of civilian deaths in drone strikes. I think they have been far too tolerant of the Obama administration's position, which does not, simply does not have credibility, that these drone strikes have been discriminating and that they have had relatively few, certainly a relatively small minority of civilian casualties as opposed to casualties of people they call militants. And the problem here, of course, is that the sources of information are only available on the ground in North and South Waziristan, where the vast majority of these strikes are carried out. So the only way for a human rights organization to take on this issue would be to go to the lawyer for the victims of the families of drone strikes, or the families of victims, excuse me, of drone strikes, and to get data from that source, or to find a way, as the Bureau of Investigative Journalism did, to go to people who have been on the ground in those places where the strikes took place, and to interview them to get the raw data in order to compare it with what the sort of official line has been. Unfortunately, we have not had organizations that have been willing or able to carry that function out so far.
Gareth Porter, you remind me of the early report about a man being killed, or actually a wedding party being annihilated in a dreadful Hellfire missile attack that was characterized as having been launched on the belief that it was Osama bin Laden because one of the gentlemen victims happened to be tall.
Yes, I mean, what you're talking about, it seems to me, is the fundamental problem here that U.S. intelligence on what is happening in North and South Waziristan in the tribal areas of Pakistan is woefully inadequate. It is not nearly good enough to claim that the United States knows what's going on and can distinguish between militants or al-Qaeda activists or pro-al-Qaeda activists in these areas and civilians who happen to be tending their fields or you know, nearby when a drone strike goes off. The fact is that there is a very high proportion of fundamental mistakes in terms of who is who in the targeting of the drone war in Pakistan. And the fact is that that this war, and people should understand this because it's very important that the credibility of the administration needs to be questioned fundamentally on this. The administration claims that the rationale for the drone war in Pakistan is to target al-Qaeda, middle and higher level al-Qaeda officials who might be planning or plotting a terrorist attack on the United States, whereas, in fact, we know from the location of the targets and where al-Qaeda and non-al-Qaeda organizations are basically based in this part of Pakistan, that the vast majority of these targets are not, by any stretch of the imagination, al-Qaeda related. They are primarily, overwhelmingly, targets which are related to fighting organizations fighting in Afghanistan. In other words, the drone war in Pakistan has become overwhelmingly an adjunct to the war in Afghanistan, a war that, of course, we all know the vast majority of the American people have now rejected. And so the very rationale, the fundamental rationale for the drone war itself is a lie. And that, I think, needs to be more broadly understood as the basis for opposition to the drone war itself.
Gareth Porter, you have done a tremendous service. You have exceeded the accuracy and acuity of organizations that characterize themselves as being human rights groups. And you have written a great piece of investigative work called Cover-Up of Civilian Drone Deaths Revealed by New Evidence. And where might people read the report in full detail and follow your work otherwise?
The report is published at Truthout, which is a very important website for investigative journalism. I've published at Truthout a number of times over the last couple of years. In fact, that's my first sort of choice when I had a long investigative piece is to publish it at Truthout. So I recommend it highly to your listeners.
Well, thank you, Gareth Porter, for joining us today on 5 o'clock Shadow. And this is an issue that apparently is not going away. There is a new form of warfare. You speak of the targeting of people who are trying to rescue the first victims. And certainly we're going to stay in touch and so happy that you could broach the subject on 5 o'clock Shadow today.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
It's been an honor. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we're now joined by Rick Rozoff, the director of Stop NATO. It's a great honor to have you with us here, sir.
The honor is mine, Robert. Thanks for the invitation.
You have been one of the most clear analysts of the growth of NATO as a tool of global domination. And I wanted to speak with you today because earlier in a press conference, President Barack Obama issued some very frightening words. He said that if the government of Syria begins moving around its so-called chemical weapons, that this would be a trigger point for a military invasion or intervention or NATO operation or whatever you might want to call it. He did not confine his statement to conduct an attack or defend a border. He said moving them around. What do you make of that?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, statements and the position statements by and the position generally of the White House and of you know the Western NATO nations as a whole are riddled with contradictions and ingenuous statements. This being one of them. You know, for example, we've heard over the last 18 months that it's an established fact that Syria already has supposedly stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons. And then Obama acts in the press conference yesterday as though this were a revelation or a new development, which is a contradictory statement, of course. And the exact statement, he's not known for being overly innovative in his use of language, is that this is a red line that the U.S. would not tolerate being crossed. He also stated, for example, that should such weapons, biological and chemical weapons, and I'm roughly quoting him, fall into the wrong hands, and that's open to interpretation too, isn't it, Robert? Does that mean that the government of Syria, simply by possessing them, constitutes a case of so-called weapons of mass destruction falling into the wrong hands? Or is he inadvertently perhaps acknowledging that should Syria possess such weapons, that the very forces being backed by the United States and its NATO allies, the armed insurgents, which include, as we know, religious extremists, including al-Qaeda elements, may get their hands on such weapons, in which case to threaten U.S. and general Western military intervention in Syria on this subject, while the U.S. And its allies are backing the very same forces they claim may come into possession of the weapons is yet another contradiction.
In other words, one red hand doesn't know what the other red hand is doing.
One bloody red hand doesn't know what the other bloody red hand is doing, or that, you know, the general feeling is we have to recall, if there's any sense of irony or paradox left in the so-called postmodern world, that on the very occasion of accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, in December 2009, Barack Obama referred quite openly, and this isn't with a sense of endorsement, embracing it, the fact that he was commander-in-chief of, and I'm quoting him, the world's sole military superpower. And presumably, if one believes oneself to be in control of the mightiest military power, the only global military power in history, then you can afford to make contradictory statements. You can afford to be playing both sides of the street, if you will, with impunity, because who's going to challenge you? So this is the the hubris of overweening power and imperial ambition.
Our guest is Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO. And Rick, one of the questions I've been looking forward to asking you is, what do you assess in the operation of the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey near Adana and the supplying of the foreign invaders, the jihadis who are coming into Syria? And you, as the leader of Stop NATO, tell us what significant operations there might be in regard to NATO and Syria.
The air base at Incirlik is one that has been used by the United States and NATO for 60 years, that is since Turkey joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's also the site where the United States maintains an estimated 90 B-61 tactical nuclear bombs, which are to be delivered by the host country, in this instance Turkey, under something called the nuclear sharing or burden sharing arrangement made between NATO powers. It has been used for military operations throughout the decades, and the military training camp, essentially, or base camp at Adana is reportedly, these are murky matters, they're rather tenebrous. I don't know if we're privy to all the details, but what we do know, even from the Western establishment press, is that the U.S. and its European NATO allies, key partners in the Middle East and in the Arab world, which is, say, the six Gulf, Persian Gulf monarchies, Qatar, Saudi Arabia in the first instance, are providing funds and presumably logistics and perhaps even arms to so-called Syrian rebels across the border in Turkey. Recent reports, which many of your listeners may be aware of from the British press in the first instance, is that the intelligence agencies of both Great Britain and Germany are actively involved in not only supplying intelligence information to rebel forces inside Syria, but presumably directing their activities, including coordinated assaults against government military forces. So we see the active involvement of NATO nations, if not officially in a collective capacity currently, Robert, then certainly unofficially, with Turkey, Britain, Germany, the United States, and others actively involved in what is pure and simple, an effort to topple the government of yet another country in the Arab world, I might add, after Libya last year, and to implant a more compliant puppet regime. We also really need to know that Syria is the only country left in the Arab world right now, out of 22 members of the Arab League, that has not had close military-to-military relations with the United States. It's the only country, in addition to Lebanon and the small island nation of Cyprus, in the entire Mediterranean Sea that is not either a member of NATO or a member of a NATO partnership program, such as the Partnership for Peace and the Mediterranean Dialogue. So by should the West succeed through proxy forces or directly in overthrowing the government in Damascus, they will have all but completed the subjugation of the Mediterranean Sea base.
Well, the other question I have for you is the close operation of the Royal Arab Nations, Qatar, which certainly trained and armed the Libyan overthrow, and Saudi Arabia, which has given at least on the order of $100 million to the Syrian Contras, and Bahrain, which is very much involved in a U.S. base and cooperation there. It seems to me that, and I think you've presented a thesis similar to this before, that NATO is becoming a global military neoplasm. It's metastasizing into something that includes more than North Atlantic nations and is involved in every part of this globe. Can you address that concern?
Sure. Immediately after, I commend you, first of all, and accurately, deeming the so-called Free Syrian Army as Contras, because that's exactly what they are, and second of all, perhaps adding to pleonasm the adjective malignant, it is by its own account a global organization. A speech was made perhaps 6 weeks ago by Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, where he, by my count, I mean, I did a word count. It was a comparatively brief speech, by the way, where there were 30-some-odd references to globe, global, international, world, and so forth in reference to the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And it's something that's being heard with increasing intensity and frequency, you know, out of the mouths of NATO officials and their respective member states' political leadership, that in fact, well, as a matter of fact, the current U.S. ambassador to NATO, Ivo Dalder, is somebody who in 2005 and again in 2006 authored or co-authored major articles, one of which bore the title Global NATO. So this is clearly the intent of the United States and its major allies in the alliance, is to expand NATO from North America and Europe to include the entire world. And, of course, they're waging war, a six-month bombing campaign against Libya last year on the African continent, marked the emergence of NATO as a yet greater global threat in that the war against Libya marked its war in the third continent. That's following, of course, the 78-day bombing war against Yugoslavia in 1999 and what will soon be an 11-year war in Afghanistan and Asia. So by their actions as well as their words, they are, you know, they aspire to be a global military intervention force. That's indisputable. The only question is, you know, whether they have the capabilities of, you know, fulfilling that aspiration, or whether the current economic crisis in Europe and other factors may, you know, militate against their being able to expand as aggressively as they choose to. But yes, this is a Western. We should recall also, Robert, that the collective population of the 28 full member states of NATO is something in the neighborhood of 900 million people. That's roughly one-eighth of the human race, yet they arrogate to themselves the right to be an international, you know, to employ their own euphemisms, security provider and so forth around the world. They have no right to do that. They have, and NATO has in many ways effectively supplanted the United Nations and the genuine international community, as is witness with their current policy vis-a-vis Syria.
Rick Rozoff is the curator of Stop NATO, one of the most highly informed information systems regarding the operations of that group. And Rick, thank you so much for being with us today. This is the first of many conversations that I think we'll be having on such subjects. Tell people how to follow your work at Stop NATO.
Yes, you could go to any search engine, Google, and just type in Stop NATO. There is, in effect, a website, though it's run by WordPress, and it's called Stop NATO. And there's a free, of course, email news list also called Stop NATO. I'm not very original myself in the choice of words, I suspect. But, you know, simply typing in Stop NATO in Google, you can immediately access both the website and the email list. And I encourage people to visit the first and sign up for the second. And thanks for the opportunity.
Well, more to come, and perhaps we will move forward on the process of reversing NATO.
Abolishing NATO.
Thank you so much, Rick Rozoff. And thanks also to Gareth Porter for the analysis of civilian deaths from drone strikes in Pakistan. And before that, Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check on the issues of women's reproductive rights and health. And that concludes today's edition of 5 o'clock Shadow. The program was produced by Chiago Brozo and engineered by Joyce Jones. We welcome your comments, leaks, tips, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Come, you masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death blades, you that build all the guns, you that hide behind walls. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You've never done nothing but to build and destroy. You play with my world as your little toy. You put a drug in my head. My
to his sorrow. You lie in D.C. The world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You that fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, then you sit back and watch while the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. Thrown the worst fear that could ever be hurled, the fear to bring children into this world, for threatening my baby. I'm born in a name. You ain't worth the blood that runs.